All right, here we go. Podcasting time, coming to you from the Rove Hotel downtown Dubai. It is Doc Talk with Dr. Jenna Burton, and we're going to be talking fitness and medicine, boxing and medicine, kids and medicine, home visits. What I just learned that you're doing home visits, so we'll talk about those. I mean, and who knows? I've got to tell you this one because I know that you're always going on that I always want to talk about jock itch.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, considering you've just given quite an extensive list of what was supposed to be Focus Podcast.
Yeah.
How we've now just thrown in jock itch.
Yeah. Go on. So there I was at Powerworks Garage. And what do you call it?
No.
Garage. Garage. You go into the garage. Yeah. Can you get a cup of tea at the garage?
No, that's like the worst English accent ever, but please carry on.
So I was at the garage and I turn around and there's DJ kind of slumped over and he's got his drawers down to his knees and he's got a handful of baby powder and he's, you know, there's a cloud. And I turn back and then I turn back around and go, what are you doing? He goes, you know, mate, it's hot now. It's like 42 in here. I gotta keep the equipment.
Crown jewels, yeah.
I gotta keep the equipment dry because otherwise I'm gonna be in itchland. And then we went into a whole discussion of the itch. And then I said, I wonder, is jock itch just a guy thing? Because guys have the equipment sort of flopping around and women don't have the equipment flopping. And I said, we'll talk to Dr. Jenna about that. He goes, you know, that would be a very good conversation. And he was legitimately interested as he reached over for honey. Had nothing to do with the
It's certainly a conversation. I'm more curious, like, to start with, at why this guy just dropped his kecks right in front of you in the middle of the garage.
Oh, no, I was facing the other direction, and I was in the
Still,
office.
It's a place of business.
It's a private area where he was.
I was going to say, so that's Powerworks Garage in Alcos.
Surprises all the time.
Yeah. Obviously, it happens more for men. It can happen for anybody. And you can get, because obviously it's normally driven by a fungal infection, that can happen anywhere in the body, normally increases. So that's why you tend to get it between your toes, between your fingers, maybe under your arm, and then in the groin region. But for men, definitely more so because, as you say, there's some equipment there. There's irritating potentially or flapping together of the skin. So it gets warmer and more likely then to hold moisture. So yeah, more likely for guys, but you can get that kind of infection anywhere in the body.
Well, then we got onto the discussion of wick away undies and things.
Wick away?
Wick away, you know, so cotton-esque things that moisture...
Breeze
and moisture gets pulled away. Wick away stuff, they call it.
I've never heard of wick away underwear, but that sounds like something I should be telling patients to use. Yeah, that sounds good, yeah.
Under Armour sells they sell a set of undies that are...
Is that the same as, you know, when you buy some of these gym tops and they've got this special climate control material, is that what it is?
I guess it's a version of that, except in many cases when it's your undergarments, it's a little more cottony and soft and stuff. But yeah, same kind of idea.
Principle.
That it breathes and pulls moisture away.
I mean, I don't get the how it pulls moisture away. It's quite clever. Unless there's like an osmotic barrier. I don't understand, but clever. Well, leave it to the engineer.
You put that tag on a pair of undergarments and you can charge a fortune for it. Like, you know, anything from Lululemon. Hey, don't get me wrong. I love Lululemon products.
Yeah, nice.
But there's a premium there.
It's very expensive.
Yeah.
Also, I don't like the fact that when you go in, they just have these like little crop tops. And pants, like really tight pants. And you've seen my gym gear. I mean, it couldn't be looser.
Yeah.
And it couldn't be further from the crop top. It's like big baggy men's t-shirts, like short shorts. So they really go for the yoga-esque vibe, don't they? But beautiful, beautiful stuff.
Hmm.
I wish I wanted to. I wish I could wear that kind of
thing. I mean, I'm just being subjective here. You walked in. I think you could get away with Lululemon stuff.
Thanks, James. But no, I think I think I'd walk into the gym and people might leave. And look, I'm all for like body positivity and stuff, but you have to feel comfortable, don't you? Especially when you're working out, you've got to feel. Funnily enough, this is actually something I say to patients that are thinking about getting fit. wear something that's comfortable. Don't feel pressured to wear what the gym goers or, you know, this typical vision of the tight, you know, tight clothing, whatever. Wear whatever makes you feel comfortable to get in there and just start.
I can never figure out why when people are at the gym, they're wearing the tight clothes. I don't get it. I kind of want something loose and airy. I mean, it still form fits a bit, but there's expandable room. So if I've got my arms up and I'm lifting something, I've got room for it to move as opposed to everything being stuck on like tight. I'm a Spider-Man suit.
I think it's a mixture of people want to show off the hard work that they've put in, number one. And number two, it's also people would disagree and say, actually, it's easier to move around when something is almost skin tight because it's almost like you're moving your own body then.
All right.
So I'd say it's a mixture of both, but just wear what's comfortable for you. I'm the same as you. I would much rather have something like light, loose, make me feel airy, you know, cool, but each their own, I suppose. As long as you get there, it doesn't matter.
One other thing I want to share with you before we get going on
talking
about gym stuff.
I get nervous when you want us to share stuff because the last thing as well.
So I'm back at PowerWorks Garage.
This is like the worst publicity for Glenn and his garage ever.
This is a great thing for Glenn and his garage. So after we're talking about the jock itch, they then look down at my big toe and they see that it's been, you know, like it's in rough shape. And they go, what the heck happened there? And I say, well, ingrown toenail. And I got I got it sorted finally. And, you know, I go into the place and I only actually finally got it sorted because it got so infected. And I was trying to deal with it myself and it just wasn't really working. And it had been infected for a long time because they said, how long has it been like this? And I'm going, I don't know, like, you know, on and off. Half a year maybe, and there, you know, there's this look of despair on the doctor's face.
Yes, I will come back to that. Go on.
And so finally went in and of all people who dealt with it, a dermatologist who numbed it, cut part of the nail off, and ended up having to actually cut down into the cuticle to do who knows what. And then they actually stitched it up, and you know, he was very proud to show me this piece of nail. And it was like, really? I was like, I'm trying to figure out where was all that nail. So he said, yeah, this was, you know,
bad.
Yeah. And he said, you're not alone in this place. Like, you're one of many who this happens to.
Ingrown toenail or infected nail?
Well, people like me who let these ingrown toenails bite. And he said, look, you just cut your nails poorly. Just don't cut them like that. And he said he sees a lot of people with infected ingrown toenails right now. So,
you know, if you have a skin infection or an infection of soft tissue, so you normally tell if there's some pus there, it's very red. There's quite a clear line between an area that is red and not red. It might feel warm to touch.
I'm checking all the boxes
there. Yeah, exactly. But you don't, James, you don't mess around with that type of infection because if that gets into your bloodstream, you get septic very quickly. Mm. And by septic, you mean a bloodborne illness, a disease, an infection like bacteria. It could be anything, bacteria, virus, whatever it may be. But it's usually a bacteria-borne illness that is then in your bloodstream. And makes you very, very ill very quickly.
Oh, man, I was lucky then. I mean, they put me on heavy-duty antibiotics.
Yeah.
One round of antibiotics just to get it down.
Yeah.
And then when I went back for the treatment, they put me on.
Yeah.
In fact, it was funny because the doctor who was looking at me, Dr. Mary, at MediClinic, and she goes, because some other doctor put me on some stuff because he was kind of, probably because he was nervous about sepsis. And she said when I came back and for the follow-up, I saw a different doctor. And she said, did those antibiotics work for you? And I went, and I'm going, oh, okay. Should have been on something else. And she said, go on these for, and she goes, I know that you don't want to be on antibiotics for too long. And you've already been on them for a course. But you know, she's feeling right. She goes, you need to be on these for another course. And then when I finally saw the dermatologist and he dealt with it, he goes, okay, you're already on antibiotics. You don't need any more. You should be fine at this point.
Yeah, we don't mess about with skin infections or infections of soft tissues because they spread quite quickly. And often you'll see people will draw a line around the area of redness to check it's not expanding. Or you can see tracking if you can see that the redness starts to follow a line because it's normally following the vein. So it's heading into the, well, it is, sort of then working its way into the bloodstream. And you can get like multi-organ failure very quickly, Really,
from a toe?
From a toe. Oh. Really, even if you have, say, a mosquito bite and you itch it, you break the skin and then a little infection starts to get in, even that can get nasty very quickly. So when it starts to go from just looking a little bit inflamed to, okay, it's really quite warm, it's red, I can see there's a very clear line between the difference of where it's red and where it's not. There's any pus coming out, you don't mess about. You go straight to the doctors and get some antibiotics. And even frequently, if it looks nasty enough, we'll put them on IV antibiotics. That might even be you get admitted to hospital for IV antibiotics. Wow. It's not a laughing matter, this, James.
I'm sorry
now. It's serious business.
But you want to know the funniest part? I go to the clinic and they do all this and... You know, the toe gets sorted, and then they say, well, you got to come back later on today. We'll change the dressing. And I'm looking at them going, what? And they go, yeah, come back later on today. I'm going, but what are you going to do? And they go, you know, we're just going to take this off, and we're going to put on a little bit. And I'm going, but I can do that at home, right? And they're going, yeah, you could, but come back here, and we'll do it. And I'm going, yeah, you're out of your mind. I'm not coming back here.
You didn't go back?
No.
James.
I did it at home.
Do you know why? Because what they were clearly very worried about the wound. Yeah. So when they invite you to come back, it's to make sure that you get a sterile dressing in a sterile environment.
I put another sterile dressing on it. And
no,
stuff.
James.
But it's funny because then when I took it off, right? And I do all stuff. I got my betadine and I cleaned it with the wash and I, you know, put my Fusidin cream on.
It's not the same environment necessarily.
But I wore rubber gloves.
Yeah, but were they sterile rubber gloves?
Yes, you know, absolutely. Wow. They come out of...
Okay. So you got surgical rubber gloves. I mean, that's a whole other level.
Do you like the sound effect?
Did you have your little aseptic surface?
No. But I did spray with this betadine dry spray. You seen that stuff?
I have not seen it.
That's cool. It makes everything red. It's kind of cool. It says it does everything. Antibacterial, antifungal, and anti-something else.
Anti-everything. I mean, it's good. The good thing is you've got OCD, and we know this. And so you probably took more precautions than a lot of other people. But generally, if they invite you at the hospital to come back or like to repeat the dressing, especially if it's just a small time span, it's because they are very worried about it getting a further infection.
So I did go back a couple of days later, and all the nurse was concerned about, is there any pain? I go, no, there's no pain at all. But I said, I did notice when I took off the dressing, there's a stitch there. What's going on with that? Because there were no instructions, right? Because... as we're talking to my wife, she goes, well, it's because they anticipate you're coming back every day and they'll deal with it. So I said to the nurse, I said, you know, she looks down. She goes, oh, you've done a good job. Got a little tap on the shoulder. Yeah. And I said, what about the stitch? Is it dissolve? And, you know, she goes, oh, no, come back in a week's time. We'll take it out. So I did go back in a week's time. They took it out.
Good. I thought you were going to say you got your kitchen scissors and hacked it out then.
After they took it out, I figured I could have done it myself. I think, why did I come back here to have this done?
Because you're just caring for... a wound appropriately. And I get it. I really do. It's so easy. And look, I'm not perfect. I've done things myself that perhaps I shouldn't have. But at the same time, like, our mission is to keep you safe and to keep you healthy and to make sure you don't get infections that are not necessary. If they invite you to come back and get your stitch taken out, even if it looks so easy, you go back and do it. Seriously.
Yeah. Well, I did.
You're just that kind of patient.
I'm the horrible patient.
It's you're the kind that just doesn't listen to advice.
Yeah. So anyway, it's all sorted.
Well done. That's good. Yeah. Don't get an infection down there again. And quite a few people also use talcum powder down on their feet to dry up any moisture, like DJ and his groin. You can also apply talcum powder to sort of dry up moisture. That's what you use it for, isn't it? So after the shower,
I put it on my feet. Huh. Okay. Well, you know what? I actually use one of those Dr. Scholl's foot things with, it's probably talc and, you know.
Yeah. Just to dry up any excess moisture. But yeah, don't make sure it's not around children too much because obviously talcum powder can get in their lungs and cause respiratory problems. But there you go.
I guess now it's baby powder that doesn't have talc in it. Because of all the lawsuits from talc and stuff.
I didn't know there'd been lawsuits from talc.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I guess because babies ingested it and lungs got destroyed. So there had been at some point some challenges. So, you know, Johnson & Johnson's baby powder does not have talc in it anymore.
Wow.
I don't know what's in it, cornstarch, something.
No, but I didn't realize there'd been like big lawsuit. But I'm not surprised because it used to be marketed as something that you use for babies. And when often at baby showers and stuff, you see one of the things that they give would be talcum powder. It's like, well, actually, you shouldn't really use that for a baby at all. it's quite aggressive to
even
them.
Even adults, apparently. I was thinking when I used to go to Golden Scissors in Ajax, and Golden Scissors hairstylist, you'd love it. Yes. The barbers there, Emilio and Joe, and you know, I forget the other guys. But you'd go there, and they always had a big bottle of talc, and they'd put it on the brush, and then they'd, you know, talc up around your neck and all that after they'd cut your hair. And I'm going, that stuff shouldn't be anywhere near your nose.
No, true. To be honest, there's
like a cloud of talc.
There's so much stuff that we use that we don't really know how it affects us. So I took the boys and Eve to get their hair cut the other day, and they've got these like super cool multicolored sprays, which they charge a fortune for a quick spray. And obviously they want to go for the rainbow style at the end. And so they look really, really smart and handsome. And then the next minute they've got like a slash of red, slash of green. You think, God, what the hell's in these? It's got to be chemicals. Yeah. And yet your children are breathing them in all the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway, side note.
Side note.
Yeah. How did we even get onto all this?
This is
your toe?
It's just the lead up. It all goes back to Powerworks Garage.
Yeah.
Get your car fixed and your health all in one place.
I just love the fact that James contacts me and says, we're going to do more focused podcast now. None of this talking around the topic. We haven't even talked about what we came to talk about.
No, we're going to talk about ringside medicine because this is boxing and I am still going, really? You do? So not only do you box, but you're a ringside doctor.
So actually, I just confirmed I'm doing the UFC again in October this year. Literally this morning I had the call. So this is something I wanted to get into from the minute I graduated. So a year after I graduated, I did a stint in Australia, and there was an ED doctor there called Paddy. He was a British guy, and he did it. And I was like, please take me with you. Will you please take me with you? I want to get trained up into this. And he's like, are you really sure? I was like, yeah, definitely. He's like, you know, it doesn't pay very well. I was like, I don't care. I just want to do it. And then no fights came up whilst I was on rotation with him. And even like years after, there was a course that was being run out of Newcastle University. And again, I contacted them. I was like, can you please tell me? I had the book. I'd read the book on ringside medicine. And it was just very difficult to get into. And then I reached out to a friend of a friend and just said, look, don't suppose you know anyone that's into this ringside medicine stuff. And he just put me in touch with the contact. And then the rest is history. And I've been really lucky to get involved. The hours
so how long have you been doing ringside medicine?
Oh, gosh, not that long. Only about a year. So I'd already done the courses. I mean, I was like ready to go because it was something I was randomly very interested in.
And what's the training involved to be a ringside doctor?
So there's different ways you can train. So you can either do like online courses like I had. There's books that are available. One is by a big professor whose name, Neetu, I think that's his name. Anyway, he's like the big ringside neurologist in New York. He's got a book. There's another one called like Association of Ringside Physicians, basically, and all about how to navigate the fight, when you should interrupt, when you shouldn't. But the biggest thing is experience. So you do the courses, you do the reading, you have to make sure you've got your acute trauma life support up to date, and then it's about experience. And there's so much that just from reading you don't get from sort of being there.
It's like everything.
Maybe a bit longer than a year, actually. I'm just thinking I started doing quite a lot of gigs at my local gym. So the gym were hosting fights, and probably quite inappropriately and on the cheap, they were like, hey, Jenna, you fancy coming to just be there? We have to just have a doctor present.
And you need the experience. And so it's a win-win.
It is a win-win, but you've got to be very careful because obviously you've got to remember about your license. And if something did go wrong, God forbid, you know, it's on your head, be it effectively. But I said, look, I'm happy to be present. And it was good. Not really much happened, especially in the white collar events. They're normally sort of suited and booted with, you know, they've got gums, you know, they've all got gum shields, but they've got like headgear on, etc. And although they can be in the white collar events a little bit more dirty, and the referees are not normally quite as hot at picking them up when they do something they shouldn't. And then sort of got to do the UFC, and then I got a contact through sort of the rings that are the Boxing Association in the Middle East, and so I've just been doing it as a bit of a hobby. So it's the hours are long, the pay's not good, but I absolutely love it, and I love watching the boxing anyway, and so I'm there ringside. I literally get sweat and sometimes blood spattered on me.
So so walk us through it at a match. Where are you in relation to the ring, and what do you tend to do?
So there's a few of us. So there's never normally just one doctor unless it is literally a very low-key, not a professional match, amateur gig. And so you normally have some, well, you try and be as ringside as possible. So you were literally on a chair right next to the ring and you have to watch the match intensely.
So you get the best view.
Well, yeah, I get the best view, but you cannot, like, you can't navigate from watching because what happens at the end is one of you at least will then go and do a post-match analysis, just check them over. If there's some suturing, stitch them up back up, potentially arrange a CT if needed, get them off to hospital if you've got to get them off to hospital, do whatever you need to do, basically decide when they can next fight. Do they need a timeout if there was a knockout, for instance? But someone should be ringside all times. And you're watching for if something major happens. And like, for instance, if somebody took a big blow to sort of like their sort of left flank region, so sort of like the left side of their lower abdomen, then you're starting to think, well, maybe there could be injury to the organs there, if they maybe ruptured the spleen if it's a little bit higher. And so then when you're doing your analysis at the end, you're doing the sort of post-fight check, you'll be examining that region in a little bit more detail, for instance. And then you also, between rounds, you'll just go and sort of check the ones over that you've been a bit worried about. Is there any neurology? Are they good? You can't do anything that would help the other fighter. So if someone's bleeding profusely, I can sort of look at them, make an assessment, maybe say to the ref, look, hey, he's really, really bleeding here, but it's not my call to stop the fight, usually. And it's not my call to then like pad up the dressing and pad in with the dressing and make the bleeding stop, because that gives the other fighter an advantage.
Does the coach on a fighter's team say if they're bleeding, do they have the stuff to stop bleeding, or can they do a quick suture themselves?
They won't do a quick suture usually, because that would again be interfering with the match, and it gives that player or that fighter an advantage. But they would obviously be trying to sort it out as best as possible. You've seen them iron the bruises out of their faces in the boxing, for instance. But yeah, the funny thing is the coaches, they're always like, it's fine, he's fine, don't worry, like no one. The referee, the associations that organise these events really genuinely care about their fighters, especially boxing. It's like a very gentlemanly, protective sport, very much so. MMA, they're a bit more like let them loose.
Let's talk boxing first.
Yeah.
Concussions.
Yeah.
This has got to be number one on your list.
Yeah, so boxing is a lot more neurology-based than other types of fighting, and that's because majority of the big blows are to the face. Obviously, they can't do a rabbit blow, which is sort of from the back, so that they're not protected, more likely to catch the C-spine, etc. So it's normally sort of a to the front or to the side blow to the face. And people become concussed very easily. Concussion is where you get like almost like an immediate swelling. The brain hits the side of the skull. The swelling, potentially you sort of burst a few blood vessels in the brain. And the brain is only so large, you know, it doesn't get bigger. The skull is a contained vault. So if the brain swells immediately, it pushes against the skull. And that can be very dangerous. So a first concussion injury is okay. If that makes sense, it's okay, the brain will settle down again. But what you don't want to get is the second concussion injury in quick succession. So once somebody shows evidence of concussion, that's them out for fighting.
Of concussion? What do you look for?
Or are they a bit dizzy, disorientated? Are they have some blurred vision? You'll normally see them stumbling a little bit. Maybe you'll say, you know, do you know where you are? I've had some fighters tell me really bizarre things at the end of the match. I'm like, do you know what month it is? They're like, is it Christmas? And it's in the middle of summer. Do you know where you are? And they're like giggling. It's like, do you know where you are? And they're embarrassed because they know that they should know where they are, but they have no idea. And then you just have to sort of like say, right, this guy, he can't fight for a few months. But yeah, it's very, very common. One of the biggest assessments in boxing, apart from looking at obviously their hands, check for any sort of fractures, and often having to suture up their eyelids, which is quite common.
Eyelids?
But the big one is
really
doing a big neurology exam. Yeah.
Wow. And you'll send people off for CT scan?
Really low threshold, send them off for a CT scan. Yeah. Especially the bigger the event, the more protected the fighters are, because they have the money, etc., to throw out, let's get them checked out properly. And the problem is a lot of the fighters are going straight on a plane after the match. So they're like, no, we don't want to go and get checked. It's like, look, you're about to go into, you know, into the sky, you need to check everything is absolutely fine, because I know very well that once you're in the air, there's nothing anyone can do about it. You have to look at trying to get an emergency landing if something went wrong. You don't know what country you're going to be dropped in. There's very limited medical expertise on board. And even if there is, what can they really do? You need to stay on the ground. So it is a bit of a challenge.
And there must be a constant back and forth then. As you said, some of these fighters, they want to get out of there.
They want to get out, and they're often very emotional. So especially if they've lost, you can't imagine trying to interact with them. Often they don't speak your language. They are devastated. I mean, they've worked for years for these fights, and there's a lot of money sometimes for these guys riding on the event. It's like the passion of the sport. It's their livelihood. It's everything. And then trying to then immediately do a medical assessment of them is really hard, and they're not compliant. They're trying to walk away. They're trying to get out. Sometimes they have taken a blow to the head. They're a little bit concussed. They're a bit disorientated. They're not quite focused. It can be really challenging.
It's almost like the opposite of medicine. You're going to somewhere where they're fighting and beating each other up, and you're there to offer some help.
They often don't want it. Yeah, frequently don't want it. And the other thing that's funny, especially the MMA fighters, all their noses have been broken. And I'm looking at the nose, and I don't want to be offensive, but it's like, you've broken your nose in the past, because obviously if it's an acute injury, because often they can't feel the pain immediately. They don't feel the pain because they're still pumped with so much adrenaline. So it's like, do I need to try and get their nose back in line now? Or do I need to send them off to the hospital, for instance? And the majority of the time, the damage has been done. It's just sort of a routine finding that their nose points in a different direction.
Let's talk MMA for a second. What do you love about MMA?
I like the type of fighting. It's more grappling on the ground. The injuries are different than more musculoskeletal. You still get the neurology, obviously, and you tend to get more chokeholds, which means you basically block the carotid arteries on both sides of somebody's head, so they pass out. So again, that's a different type of medicine, effectively. But I think it's the musculoskeletal stuff that I really like from MMA. And I love the boxing because it is more gentlemanly, sensible, caring. The MMA is glamour.
it's all like, out. It's gladiator style, really.
Exactly. You know, the hosts, they make a show. You know, the MMA, it's more a show, especially with the UFC. The fighters are very different as well. They're normally a little bit younger. They're feisty. The way the rounds are, it's not as long. In the boxing, you get really invested because you get to see them over quite a long period of time. Although there are more knockouts, especially in the sort of heavier weight categories. But for the MMA, I don't know, they're all completely crazy from this minute that they start. So no, I do like it.
They're not wearing any equipment. They don't have any protective gear on.
No, they are like animals. But
it's got to make your job hard then, if you're ringside watching to assess and put your hand up to say, hold on a second, we got to take a time out here.
You do more, I would say, ringside assessments. So you'll go up to the ring and check them out. I go into the cage between every single round in MMA. In the boxing, I won't. I'll assess, sit back. Then if there is, you know, someone that looks like maybe they just need checking, we'll just go and give them sort of a glance, have a chat with them. You okay? How you doing? You know, how many fingers am I holding up? But in the MMA, you have to go and check between every single round.
How many doctors did you say would... So when you're doing the MMA stuff, that's coming up. This is really exciting.
It's not until October, but I loved it last year, so I'm excited.
How many of you will be working the ring?
There was quite a few of us last year. And in fact, with the UFC, because it's such a big international, it's a media company, isn't it, really, as well? It's media and it's fighting. They had surgeons specifically that stayed at the back just doing the suturing, so it wouldn't be me doing it. They'd have surgeons just set up in their own, like, little mini hospital, effectively. And then there would always be two doctors on each side. So one would then go and do the assessments and come back, and then the next one would go and do the assessment. So there'd be at least one, two, three, four, five, six of us, at least six, but probably a few more for that one. That's big. That's a big event. But usually you're sort of looking at about two, three doctors for typical boxing.
Do you foresee down the road, students who are going to medical school, there's actually a little bit of a, you know, specialization in ringside medicine or, you know, UFC stuff or, you know, contact sport medicine?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I wanted to get into it for ages and I was kind of told, look, you don't really need anything. You know, I did courses.
I mean, you do all the trauma stuff. Like you're...
Well, I love the trauma stuff. And to be honest,
it's kind of the same, right?
It is, but I don't have as much exposure now as I did. Mm. So when I go back to the UK for the summer, I will go back into working in emergency. And that's, you know, that is something that I'm very passionate about. But for this, for me, it kind of fills that void because I obviously work in a clinic and I'm doing lots of general health stuff and cosmetics. And I love that. I love it. But then I guess that passion comes alive when I go, what are you laughing at? Because it's so different.
I'm laughing because previous podcasts that we've done, we've talked Botox and we've talked, you know, vitamins, and we've talked about, you know, all sorts of things that you can do, needling and things to make yourself look glamorous. You do this on one side, and then you're on the ring where people are undoing all of that good stuff.
Yeah, it's a bit, there's something wrong with me, really. Like, I have very, very good interest.
Oh, you said it, not me.
even the other day, I was putting Profilo in, the hyaluronic acid, into his skin, this patient. I don't know how he got into it, and then he started talking to me, and I was like, I'm really into sort of martial arts, and I do some of the matches, the boxing matches. He's like, what? I was like, no, I can't explain it. But that's the beauty of medicine. And you'd be surprised. I almost feel like I've done such a varied degree of medicine.
You're all over the map with your medicine stuff.
But it kind of all knits in back together anyway. It just does. It all complements each other in a very weird and wonderful way. And, you know, I'm not going to start delivering babies tomorrow. You know, that takes a specialist up in gynae. Oh, no, I can't stand obstetrics and gynecology. Mm. That's my only area where I will very much happily stay away. But, you know, health all fits in. Eventually, all the lines come back together. And I absolutely love it. And I love the fact that I'm lucky enough to be in a clinic talking about general health and doing my cosmetic procedures up by day. And then sort of come 10 o'clock that night, you know, by the ring and looking at, you know, getting someone an emergency CT scan and putting their eye back together. I love it. What a great career is that? How lucky am I? You know, really lucky.
One of the things you said is ringside medicine doesn't pay so well.
No.
Why? I mean, to me, that should be one of the big things. We want to have great doctors here and we want to make sure they're well compensated because this is our livelihood, are these people who are in the ring beating each other up.
Yeah, I think maybe if you're one of the head doctors that organizes, like getting the all the equipment there, et cetera, like maybe there is a financial gain to be had, but you find most people that do it because they're passionate about it. So I started kickboxing when I was like 18, 19. Maybe a bit younger because I maybe did boxer size with my dad for a bit first. So
boxer size?
Yeah, when I was younger, like, you know, a teenager. And then...
I've heard jazzercise. I have never heard
of boxer. You've never had a boxer size?
No, never.
We've been living, James. So basically, it's you have gloves on and it's exercise, but you might be doing push-ups and sit-ups. And as you get to the top of the sit-up, you bang a couple out and then you will run around, but you keep going back to bang. Like,
all right, well, maybe I've done some of that with Les Mills, some of those.
Yeah, that's it. That's boxer size. Okay. But then I got into kickboxing in university and I'm still terrible. I'm absolutely awful. Anyone will tell you more arms
and legs. Kickboxing, again, that's musculoskeletal. You're trying to hit people in the head. You're hitting them in the stomach and...
Yeah, it's there's a lot of MSK stuff. But like
MSK, musculoskeletal.
But it's like you'll find that most people that are there, they all in their sort of personal life will be involved in something, whether it's they've done boxing in the past, maybe they're ex-boxers, you know, whatever it may be. They do it because they're really passionate about it. And to be honest, I have done quite a lot of matches where I didn't even get paid. And these games, like, you got to be there maybe 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon and you're there until like 3 a.m. in the morning. And I've got 3 young children. I've got to be up early the next day.
And there's that misconception. Doctors are doing these things. You're professionals. You're getting well compensated. Really, it's not necessarily the case.
No, this is a passion project. And I think my boss once took me aside and he said, like, Jenna, you should be using your time more wisely. And I said, but look, some people go out drinking this is my night out. It's my, like, I absolutely buzz off the atmosphere, the energy, meeting the coaches, meeting the fighters, learning about sort of a different area of medicine, because you learn something every single time that you go. You know, and it's great because it's a passion of mine that, and I happen to have some medical experience, and then to combine the two is just great.
You talked about some of the must-read materials for this field. In doing the things with the MNA and all that stuff, and then you think back to these books, are there times when you kind of go, yeah, yeah, they got that right on, or, oh, you know what, actually, it's a variation?
No, because it's a pretty new sport, like, as in, it's a new area of medicine. I'd say it's pretty bang on, to be honest. And the only thing that is a little bit different, for instance, is maybe the times that you have to take out of, like, so you're medically unfit for another match. Sometimes that changes depending on the level of fighter, how bad the injury is. Sometimes that changes a little bit, but otherwise, no, it's pretty accurate. And also, it's not rocket science medicine, is it?
You know, I always think it is.
No, it's, well,
is it just following procedures? And it's,
well, no, it's basically just looking at your injuries, and you're thinking about the mechanism of injury. There's only so many different types of mechanism of injury in boxing matches, and more so in MMA, because there's only certain ways you're allowed to approach your fighter. I think what's been interesting is doing the matches, I've probably learned more about the fighting itself and the rules and regulations, because that's actually a big part of it as well. And I hadn't appreciated that when I first started. And I'd be like, why are they doing this? What does that mean? Okay, this bell means this. Hang on, why is the ref come in and intervene now? So I've learned a lot more about that, which I also really enjoy. But I have to say, I don't know whether you've seen the new power slap that's been brought out by the president of the UFC.
No.
But this is nuts. Right? I'd love to be one of the doctors for this.
Power slap.
Right. So this is a new sport, and I'm saying that in inverted commas, sport, and it's got a lot of backlash. So say you and I were fighting each other. Fighting.
And just for the record, not a chance. Judo, kickboxer, you're
I'm not very good, James.
You go hang out with it. You're not very good, but you do it. You're not very good is going to leave me on the ground convulsing in pain and crying like a baby.
I'm really not sure. Like, any of the guys that I do it with would tell you that, like, I'm absolutely terrible. But anyway, this so you would say it was my turn to get you. You have to hold a little pole behind your back, and you have to stand up straight, and you're not allowed to flinch or move or do anything to protect yourself. I have to take a straight hand, so I can't lead with my palm, my hand. I have to take a straight hand, gather momentum, and then slap you as hard as I can across the face. And loads of people are getting really significant brain injuries.
This sounds to me like redneck party games.
Wait till I show you the videos. It's mental.
I've seen this on Instagram with, you know, the backwoods boys doing these things. This is, they've made this into a sport.
they've tried to make it into a sport, but it is getting quite a lot of backlash, like, especially medically, because the thing is, it's so dangerous that it could kill somebody on the spot, because the momentum and the direction of force with the hand could literally completely dissect your carotid arteries, which is the main blood supply to the brain. So it could actually just kill someone there on the spot. So I have a feeling it's not going to be like a goer. I mean, good on the people that are trying to sort of make some money out of this. And also, I'm sorry to the people that think it's a good idea to go and get involved themselves.
Yeah. No, this sounds absolutely no.
Well, tell you what, though, interesting to watch. Literally, they hit them, and then the people just fall over straight away, and it's like, I don't understand.
But and so how many times would you get to hit someone before they get to reciprocate?
No, I think it's one each.
One each.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I haven't followed the sport.
And how do you practice that with a punching bag and just, I don't even want to think about this.
No, I don't know, but they've got some pretty big geezers involved.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And also like the women, you know,
there's women doing this too.
Yeah. Oh. One of them I saw, she got hit, and as she got hit, she fell and did a rollover on the floor and then fell, you know. It's like, wow, God. So yeah, that's the new age of the sport. But generally, I have to say, apart from the power slap, the athletes are really cared for. And I don't I didn't have as much respect for how cared for they are. There's also huge, huge procedures and policies before the fight even takes place to decide who is fit to fight. You have to be cardiovascularly fit, musculoskeletally fit. You've even got to have conversations about your eyes, your eyesight. You have to be able to defend yourself appropriately. And I think the sport doesn't get enough recognition for that. You just think about people fighting each other. Theoretically, it is a little bit mad.
You get guys up there with contact lenses in and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, well, that's what you've got to be careful of. Yeah, yeah. Of course. Of course you do. But also people that have had refractive eye surgery, like certain types of laser or maybe even a surgical procedure to open up their, cornea and then treat it with a laser and then put it back again. They are more at risk of damaging their eye if they were to get punched in their eye because their cornea is more vulnerable to being sort of ripped apart effectively. And you have to have these conversations with them beforehand.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's not everybody gets to fight, only the right people. And obviously they've got to have the right mentality and, they know what they're getting themselves in for generally, but you have to check the safe.
You have boxer size, you have kickboxing, you're in the ring with UFC. I imagine you do a little bit of that yourself. And you've got judo. You're into judo.
I only just started judo.
No, my mother was a big judo person.
Really?
Yeah, second degree black belt.
I think I'd like...
Olympic referee.
She wasn't?
Yeah, she
was. Was she?
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing, yeah, James.
Yeah, yeah.
How come you didn't get into it? Are you not tempted?
When my mom was, the sensei, we used to go to the, I maybe got to blue belt or brown belt. I can't remember. But yeah, we used to go to judo.
Wow, so yeah. You'll know a lot more than I will.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, but you still know a lot more than me. But she had a few lessons. But I got into the MMA, so I quite liked it. But I wanted to go back and learn the fundamentals and the more skill aspect. And I used to go to a BJJ gym for years, but they also did kickboxing and I fancied it, but I hated the thoughts of working out in a dressing gown.
Right.
And anyway, now I've started working out in a gi, it's actually not so bad, but for ages it really put me off. And everyone was like, you should get into it, I'm sure you'd love it. And I do, I absolutely love it, but I have a feeling I'm going to prefer the jiu-jitsu more than the judo because I like the wrestling. And it's a really good workout. It's totally different.
Judo's got a little wrestle in there, not as much as jiu-jitsu, though.
It's more takedowns, isn't it?
Yeah, takedown and that holding and trying, you got your hand on the gi and you're just trying to.
James, come and do it with us. Yeah. Let's do it. Yeah. We can do a show from there.
Maybe we should.
Yeah, everyone.
I'm not doing any judo, but I'll come and talk to you guys.
No. You've got to do it. But the thing is I'm trying. In fact, I was having a bit of a heated debate with somebody recently because he was saying, sports about performance, it's results driven, whatever. And it's like, look, it's really not. I'm not very good at the majority of stuff I do in exercise land. But I'm just up for giving stuff a go. And, I've told you I'm going through my second midlife crisis already, the age of 37. And I'm up.
I don't know how that's possible.
and I'm up for giving anything a go. And it keeps you fit. It's something a bit different. To be honest, it's not particularly expensive. It's no more expensive than going to the gym to sort of lift some weights. And it's just nice to try something different. I miss doing my kickboxing, and obviously time is finite, so I can't sort of give my attention to that for a while. But for a bit, I'll give judo a go. I'm not probably going to do any belts or anything. I just want to...
You got to do some belts.
I just want to see what... I don't want to learn all the words.
You can't just stay as a yellow belt forever.
Who cares? Who cares? As long as you turn up, you enjoy it, and you get a little bit fit in the process, and you learn to defend yourself, which is a huge skill. Yeah, I think we need to take away the fact that we're supposed to progress and achieve something. Sometimes you just want to do something for the sake of it. And at the moment, doing the judo on my Friday morning suits me. But let's see, who knows what tomorrow will bring.
And it's just that mental fitness as well. Just you're out, you're doing something. I think we underestimate the value of that.
There's the mental fitness, the mental discipline that goes with it, but also it's the community and the people that you meet too. Like I normally come out buzzing, and part of it is obviously sort of learning something new and doing some exercise in sort of that moment, but a lot of it is just interacting with nice people and coming away and you've had a bit of a laugh. And I think it beats running on the treadmill every day. You know, it's it's nice to do something a little bit different.
Yeah, a lot of fun for sure. What's going on in the we talked a little bit about all these things, but I'm just curious, what's going on in the shop these days? What's going on
what,
in the office?
Shop?
The office. I call it the shop. Yeah. What's coming in?
What is coming in?
I can tell you what's coming in. I'm an extraordinary number of people seem to be testing again for COVID, and I don't get it. The people I talk to all have colds, coughs and colds. I'm talking to them, they're sniffling, and it's like, what's going on, Oz?
Do you know, I have hardly seen any health patients recently because my clinic is actually fully booked with people coming in for Botox because they're going away for the summer holidays. So everyone's going away for the summer holidays. So all my medical patients are coming in. I'm like, is everything okay? Yeah, I've just come for my Botox.
Okay.
Because I'm traveling. So there's a heck that we actually ran out. We always have wow. huge stores. We ran out of Botox. There's so many people wanting to sort themselves out before they go. So that's that. And then the other thing is perimenopause. I can't tell you how many people are coming in.
Yeah.
Anxiety, yeah. likely related to sort of perimenopause. Depression, likely related to perimenopause. Feeling scatty, likely related to perimenopause. I'm getting a huge surge of patients coming in with hormonal difficulties. So yes, there's always coughs and colds and stuff like that. But I wouldn't say that has been sort of primarily what I'm seeing at right at the moment. There's a lot of people doing general health checks, knowing that they're traveling for a while. There's a lot of people coming sort of worried about their appearance because they're traveling for a while. And then there's a lot of people that are just suffering with sort of the coming of age. Dubai is getting older.
Yes.
And we are having to support a different generation of Dubai, aren't we?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I want to jump back to sports just for a second because I forgot something. You're also into beach volleyball.
No, I'm not. I've got so bad.
But you give it a go.
Right. What happened?
Need to know, if you're doing beach volleyball, you need the Lululemon gear because one does beach volleyball in...
I did it in my shorts and t-shirt again. I know.
I'm
not cool. I never said I was a cool dude. So all that happened is my friend said, do you want to go and meet on the beach on Sunday morning early and do beach volleyball? And I said, does being able to play, is that a prerequisite? And they said no. And then my other friend said that he was terrible. And I was like, I really, truly hope in the nicest way possible that you are awful because that would make me feel better. Anyway, they were all absolutely brilliant.
Of course.
And I could serve, but when the ball came at me fast, I literally screamed like a chicken and ran away from it. So will my volleyball career be long and extensive? Probably not. If they suggest it this week, will I go? Probably, yeah. It was nice to be on the beach. I've always looked at the volleyballers and thought, how great would that be to do?
Yeah.
You know, like sort of a nice active outdoor-y type sport. But I think I've got a long way to go, James.
Oh, yeah. Jenna, this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah,
as always, we've caught up. We've had a little bit of a chat.
Everything.
we've been all. This is a complete variety medical show.
Yeah,
we talked about everything and a little bit more. So I look forward to doing it again sooner than later.
Yeah, hopefully, can't wait. Thanks, James.
Thank you. You've been listening to Doc Talk with Dr. Jenna Burton. I'm James Pikeaway, and we'll do it all again real soon. Hey, you know what? Wherever you're watching us or listening to us, subscribe, leave a comment, like us. We want to hear from you. Talk to you soon.